Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to The Tonight Show. Sinn Féin tables a motion to tackle waiting times for spinal surgeries. We speak to the mother of 10-year-old Kylie-Ann Stewart, who's been left waiting years for an urgent operation.
In 2018, my daughter's back was bad. And as the years pass on, every year you see how much more it has come out. You just feel like you're hitting a wall all the time.
Dr. Umar Al-Qadri joins us in studio to talk about his assault in Dublin last week and the changes he's making around security. And the United States pushes for a temporary halt in fighting in Gaza using the word ceasefire for the first time. In 2017, a report by the Ombudsman for Children said long waiting times for spinal surgeries constituted a denial of the rights of young people. It said no child should have to wait for surgery for more than 4 months. The Minister of Health at the time committed to this target. Since then, the number of children waiting for orthopaedic surgeries has grown and now stands at 327, with three quarters of those waiting longer than 4 months. Today, a Sinn Féin tabled a motion in the Dáil to address the issue. One of those children was in the chamber. 10-year-old Kylie-Ann Stewart has been waiting 5 years for a crucial operation on her spine. Earlier, Ciara Doherty spoke to her mother about the agonising wait for treatment.
So Kylie-Ann was born with spina bifida hydrocephalus. So spina bifida, if you imagine, part of the spine is missing. It didn't form. So then the spine then starts to protrude as she grows. And so the bone is pushing out. So it's like basically bone is coming through her skin. And in 2018, we were told that she required a kyphectomy. And we've been on a waiting list since. We've had two scheduled surgeries in, not last year, the year before. Both cancelled last minute, and we are still awaiting a date.
When those operations are cancelled, what reasons do they give you?
So they just ring and say, it's very unfortunate, but we need to cancel it. We don't have the nurses to care for her after her surgery. So we'll send you out a new date. And the second time probably we were told that the surgeon was no longer dealing with complex surgeries. So then we had to wait then to a new surgeon was appointed to Kylie-Ann. And that's what I mean when we transferred then across to Crumlin.
What is it like as a family for yourself and for Kylie-Ann when they do cancel those operations?
Heartbreaking, because now in 2018 my daughter's back was bad, and as the years pass on, every year you see how much more it has come out and how much her spine is protruding and her back, and you see the skin break down time after time, and you worry every time, is she going to get an infection? Sepsis is always in the back of your head. It's just, you live in fear. Like, I remember someone saying to me about COVID, and I says, my life every day is fear. I says, so no, I don't fear COVID, because when I watch my daughter every day, I fear that she's going to get an infection if her skin breaks down. So this chair that she has here, she cannot use that when she comes in from school. she has to come out of it. That is only for when we're out in a public place or when she's at school. Because the longer she's in the chair, the more friction she can cause to her back.
Over the course of the 6 years, how has Kylie-Ann's condition changed?
So Kylie-Ann now struggles at school with writing because she suffers a lot of pain from here down into her arms. She has lost lung capacity. And we were actually very shocked to know this. Like,
what was the curvature in her spine a couple of years ago?
So it probably would have started off like over 50. In February, we would have had her scan at her normal spina bifida clinic, and she was a curve of 102. And we had a scan in November, and she was at 138. So she has like a cushion on her chair, but like if I removed her from the chair, you can see the indent on the seat that she sits on every day. Like, that's how sharp.
Will the delay that you've experienced and Kylie-Ann has experienced, will that make the surgery more complicated?
Kylie-Ann's surgery is more complicated than if it had been done when she required it back in 2018.
Despite, Catherine, the deterioration that you have seen in Kylie-Ann's condition, you still have no date for surgery.
That's correct, yeah. You just feel like you're hitting a wall all the time. So you do. So I just hope that after today that these TDs give us the backing we need. Because if we get that motion passed, it will give us more prayers to fight for our children. And hopefully people will listen to us then.
Do you feel you're not being listened to?
All the time. I just feel like you're hitting a wall all the time. You're continuously fighting.
And I'm so conscious that Kylie-Ann is here beside you. And Kylie-Ann isn't going to speak, but she has joined you for this interview. She's very conscious, clearly, of what is going on. And it must be taking its toll on her too.
Mentally, Kylie has a lot to deal with. First of all, she has a hard life to begin. She has to deal with being in a chair every day. And she goes through all those feelings. And this is just another added problem. Like, if you had surgery, you wouldn't be dealing with that. Like, Kylie has often, she went through different phases in life, right from not realising there was anything wrong with me, right up then until she realised everybody around me is running about, why am I not walking? And I remember, and I always say this, she says to me, "Mom, when I'm 5, do you think I will be able to walk?" And I says, "Kylie, God made you special. You'll never walk. You'll just use this chair." And it took a full year, I'd say, before she came out of that phase. So, like, this big surgery that she's waiting on is just another added problem that you just don't need.
At 10 years of age. Could you get to the point where Kylie-Ann's condition becomes inoperable?
We could, yeah. Like, our surgeon told us when we saw him that he wouldn't want to see her even another 10 degrees. And that was, like, before Christmas. So, like, as every week passes and we'd be emailing but still no date.
You're joining the protest today. What is your message to politicians?
I want you to look at my daughter the way we look at her. Love her the way we love her and give her the quality of life that she deserves. And every child like her. That is my message to every politician that has given a vote in that dial today. Just give them the quality of life that you'd want for your own child, your own grandchild. If you have a heart at all, just please listen to us.
Catherine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Catherine Stewart and her daughter Kylie Anne there speaking to Ciara Doherty a little bit earlier. Well, joining me to discuss this are Fianna Fáil Senator and Seanad Spokesperson on Health, Lorraine Clifford-Lee, Sinn Féin TD and Party Spokesperson on Health, David Cullinan, the co-leader of Spina Bifida and Hydrocephalus Paediatric Advocacy Group, Una Keatley, and by Paul Cullen, Health Editor with the Irish Times. And we requested Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly to join us on the programme tonight, but he was not available. I want to come to you first then, Lorraine Clifford-Lee, on this. It struck me there, as Catherine said, as she said many things, and she spoke of her heartache. I think anyone watching that would say it's a heart-wrenching piece to see the emotion on little Kylie Anne's face as she sat through this, as her mother explained their situation. But Catherine said, we're not being listened to, we're hitting a wall all the time, and it's not just the daily fear of infection brought on by delays, but also the fear that her condition will be completely inoperable. What are you saying to her when she says, we're not being listened to?
I think you're right. It was a very harrowing interview, and I think Catherine gave a very good account of the situation, and I've heard that account from many other parents over the years. And these children and their families have been failed by the state over the years, and the situation that many of them have been left in is inhumane. I can't describe it in any other terms. But I think Minister Donnelly is listening to the parents. He is listening to the advocacy groups. He has met with some of them. I know the invitation is there to meet with other advocacy groups because he is trying to improve this situation.
And is progress being made?
Progress is being made insofar as there's extra resources gone into the system. A record number of surgeries have taken place. It's had a negligible impact on the waiting lists, however, because there has been an increase of 40% on the referrals to the waiting lists.
I'm just thinking about what Catherine had to say there, that, you know, she had two cancellations in 2022. Mm-hmm. At that point, she'd already been waiting for 4 years.
Yeah, and since then, 19 million was put into the system to clear the waiting lists. 200 extra healthcare professionals have been dedicated specifically to this matter. A new theatre was opened in Temple Street, an MRI facility is put into Crumlin Hospital.
So what's going wrong?
What's going wrong, and Minister Donnelly referred to it in the Dáil earlier on, the 19 million that was allocated to Children's Health Ireland to clear the waiting lists, and it was taken outside the budgetary process. And it hasn't had the impact. So he has actually called the HSE audit team. He has called the HSE audit team into CHI to figure out what happened and to actually map that 19 million back onto the services, because something has happened in the system, and it's not from the lack of government resources, and it's not from the lack of willingness and understanding on behalf of the minister and action on behalf of the minister.
That amount of money, 19 million euro, because that's what Children's Health Ireland said. You know, if you give 19 million euro, we will see the waiting list down to a maximum of 4 months per child
by the
end of this
year. Absolutely, and that was provided by the
government. That money was provided, but it went into what, a black hole?
Well, we don't know exactly. I don't think it completely went into a black hole, but it's clear that it hasn't had the impact, and we want to find out why that hasn't had the impact. But can I say as well, apart from that, a dedicated unit has been set up within Children's Health Ireland. That's international best practice. It's based on, there's a clinical lead. He's recruiting a team. He just started in January. So a lot has been done, but that doesn't impact on the harrowing story we heard there this evening from Catherine.
And I'm thinking about what the Ombudsman for Children, Niall Muldoon, had to say, because he was the person who spoke out about this, saying this is a basic children's right. And on foot of that, it was Simon Harris who said in 2017, OK, yeah, 4 months is the max time that a child will have to wait for spinal surgery in this country. Now, he's calling on the government to honour its commitment that it made 7 years ago. Will the government do that?
I can only talk about the government that has been in place for the past 3.5 years. And Minister Donnelly has been the minister that has actually done something to address this issue. It's been an ongoing issue. It's been a catastrophic failure from start to finish, really.
He stepped into that job quite a while ago when these problems were ongoing and people like Catherine and her daughter were highlighting this story.
Absolutely, and he has delivered an awful lot of resources and put together the system. But can I say there has been an increase in the population? There's been an increase of 40% in the referrals into...
How does that change cancer surgery from 2022 that we don't have a new date on in the case of Catherine?
I don't know exactly what is the issue there, but there has been a record increase in spinal surgeries in the system.
So, I'd like to bring you in at this point.
Just on the referrals, we're looking at a 40% increase, and we're looking at years that we had COVID where you were told there was no appointments happening. We have an increase in population. We have the highest rate of spine bifida in the world. It's not rocket science that we get an increase in referrals when you look at COVID years when there was no appointments happening. A fifth theatre opened. Indeed, it did in Temple Street. And what happened? The fourth theatre has been closed for renovations. We're still at four theatres, right? Minister Donaldson also made the commitment in February 2022 that no child would wait longer than 4 months for spine bifida. The new spinal unit, where is it? There's no phone number. There's no location. It exists in the third realm. Parents can't phone that unit.
The spinal head surgeon was appointed in January. He was appointed in January and he's assembling a team.
But it's not established.
He was appointed. The unit was established in January.
Right?
It's not bluff. A team is being recruited.
It's not available. I cannot ring that in the morning and say, hello, spinal unit. You know, I'm ringing. It's like the Holy Spirit unit. Yes. It only exists in imagination.
I think that's disingenuous. You've obviously been strongly calling for it, and over and over, commitments
that have not been honoured. Bernard Gloucester met us in September 2023 and advised that there would be 9 spinal liaison officers set up in this state, one for each CHO area, to help us navigate this mess of services that our children are in. And there, again, there's no phone number. There's nobody.
What reason were you given as to why those officers are not in place? Like, what's the excuse?
The National Patient Safety Office have yet to respond to us on why those numbers aren't there.
OK, David Cullinan, I want to bring you in at this point because Sinn Féin brought forward a motion around this, around a task force being established to look into it to reduce waiting times. What are you doing or promising in that motion that the government isn't already committing to but failing to deliver on?
Well, I think that all of those parents and children that were outside the door today and in the public gallery have had a belly full of promises from politicians, and what they want is action. I met Kylie Ann and her mum. She was one of 20 children that were in the public gallery today listening to the debate. I personally have a very low tolerance threshold for children in pain, and I think all of us do, and we want more to be done. I find it very heartbreaking. I find it distressing. I listen to all of the parents, all of the children tell their stories, and they are really heartbroken that promises have been made time and again, and then they've been let down. So go back to the promise that Simon Harris made 7 years ago, that no child would wait longer than 4 months. That didn't obviously happen and hasn't materialised. And then Minister Donnelly, and I was astounded today with his contribution. He said that he signed off on €19 million, which he did. We welcomed that at the time. Campaign groups welcomed it because obviously we want more investment, more capacity. And then he told us today in the Dáil that he could not say for certainty that all of the money was spent for the purposes of which it was intended. He was told that the basis for the €19 million was that he was given a commitment from Children's Health Ireland that if that money was committed, that no child would have to wait longer than 4 months.
That was the magic number.
That was the magic number. Today, we have 327 children with scoliosis on waiting lists. That's higher than when Simon Harris made the promise in 2017. So there is an awful lot of spin here in relation to numbers because we had different numbers in terms of waiting lists coming from different ministers. The bottom line is in what you heard in your package earlier. Kylie Ann is waiting 5 years. And it isn't just because you're asking what needs to be done. The reason why that the advocate groups and parents want a task force is because they are so disillusioned with all of these broken promises and a lack of accountability. If I can make this point, if we have a Minister for Health that over the last 2 years wasn't ensuring that the €19 million was spent for the right purposes and ensuring that the target that was set was met, is it no wonder that parents then are so mistrustful of the system? There is issues in
the task force is being set up.
We've heard
this. No, there's no task force in place at the moment. It's
okay,
a promise.
So the government task force has been promised, and what Sinn Féin is doing is saying, right, we'll get to work on that immediately?
I think Lorraine needs to better understand what's happening here with respect to it. There is no task force currently set up. What we were seeking, what we were seeking in the motion today was for a task force that has real teeth, that the parents and advocate groups would be a central part of that with clinicians, and then we move away from all of these false promises and a lack of accountability.
And that is,
let's actually bring a level of transparency to this issue. It certainly is not.
It is.
Paul Cullen, to bring you in on this, because you've been writing extensively about it. What is actually, is there a shortage of senior surgeons who can do complex surgeries, or what is going on here that we are seeing these years-long waiting lists for surgery for children, which would be life-altering for them?
Yeah, sure. And we're asking, well, why are we talking about this again? We don't want to be. I don't think anybody wants this, and nobody wants to witness that harrowing interview and see this happen maybe in a year's time. I think the particular case that you featured there is a combination of two issues. One is the chronic issue. Well, if you go wider in the health service, we haven't managed to deal with waiting lists generally, OK? So this is a specific cohort, and it's a very heart-rending and harrowing particular situations that these children find themselves in. But also, there's a particular situation since last September in Temple Street where the one surgeon who is able to do the most complex surgeries on children is off the pitch, effectively.
So tell us about the impact of that.
Well, I was wondering about that. From the figures, surgeries are still proceeding at Temple Street, but not complex ones. So no matter how much we talk about task forces and so on, we don't have an immediate solution to the most complex and most glaring delays in the system.
We so when we do. Heard reports over the weekend just about those waiting lists coming down...
Are you going to do them, David?
That was not in relation to complex surgeries. That was all surgical procedures.
Yeah, there's a bit of a blizzard of figures.
I have to just come back to what Paula said there, because it isn't fair. There are some children who are able to access private healthcare, and I want all children to have equal access to that care. So it is the case that in some clinics in Ireland, private clinics, they can't provide some of these surgeries. I spoke to the former head of the HSE, who at the time when Simon Harris was the Minister for Health, when that commitment was given, had put in place a plan. And part of that plan was to offer treatment abroad for those children who could avail of it.
OK, so that's treatment abroad, but that's different to treatment in private clinics.
I know, but... My point is that that was then discontinued long before COVID.
OK, but are there private hospitals that can carry out this specialised surgery?
Well, there are children that can get some services, not all of the services.
Because she's speaking for families.
Not for complex children. No, there is not. There is, like, we cannot avail of, we cannot travel abroad because our children require ventilators and different things like that. We can't bring them privately. But the point is, and in these figures, what's disgusting in these figures is, and what government ministers are failing to report, is that all children, all complex surgery for children with spina bifida has ceased across CHI. CHI Temple Street have not performed spinal surgery on a child since 2022, and Crumlin have not performed one since I think September 2023. You cannot deliberately alienate a whole cohort of children and say, due to your disability, sorry, not for you, and oh, we've come down 4%. What would happen in the morning if we said, sorry, everyone in Cork, no treatment for you, but we're going to bring down the figures everywhere else?
So do we need more surgeons to be able to perform these surgeries?
We do.
Are there other issues that are prompting the cancellation?
We're going to insource surgeons. We got that soundbite from Minister Donnelly in October. There's been no new surgeons. There's been no posts advertised across CHI. And CHI, the ones who have mismanaged the care of our children, are now queried about the mismanagement of funds. We're expected to believe that they're going to manage a task force effectively. They will not. And we need to be listened to as...
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Parents, this task force must be independent of CHI, it must be statutory, and it must be expert-led.
Well, okay. I've looked very closely.
Lorraine, can I get you in on that? There are big questions that need to be asked then, really. I mean, not least, we talk about this 19 million euro, which was promised to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And clearly, you know, the minister is not sure where that money's gone.
And that's why he has called the auditors in to actually find out, because that's a very serious situation.
But why is that audit just being prompted now? I mean, was that not in the budget 22? As an extra,
yes, it was. Yeah, and it was provided and it was working through at that the point. System. But it's all clear right. now that the it hasn't had the effect, and the minister wants to find out exactly why.
But we've already heard, and we've heard from Una, that they have been consistently pushing a lack of services, the fact that they're, you know, that these surgeries are not being carried out.
So in June,
the problems have been there and been highlighted.
The money was given in February. We were all absolutely delighted. We thought this was going to bring things. By June, we actually saw that things were getting worse. We contacted Minister Donnelly and we said there's a serious issue here. The funding has been given and the children are in a worse state than they have ever been. And we wrote to him and we emailed him and we never received a response.
And the task force is being established. The terms of reference are being put together. Stakeholder groups are being brought in because the minister wants to see progress.
All right, Paul.
Well, the minister convened a meeting yesterday with patient groups. There are at least five of them. And your group and another group didn't go along. If you go and talk to the minister, to be fair to him,
yeah,
he
but
can't
it was
be expected
Section 39
to
charity, HSE semi-funded charity. And I think anyone who stands up and supports the minister's position and says, I'm an advocacy group, is going to get a seat at the table. And to be fair, right, the Scoliosis Advocacy Network got that Ombudsman report done in 2017. We've been meeting with CHI since 2017. We're on the CHI family forum. We've been on co-design boards. He said himself, the minister, that the co-design boards haven't worked. We're not going to put another rebranding of the co-design board as a task force
will,
that
will
isn't
meet
independent.
The minister, Una, or what's stopping you from meeting the minister?
We asked for an agenda. We said we had certain things we wanted to discuss and could we get a commitment that they would be...
And
that
he gave you that commitment.
But you wouldn't, and you wouldn't meet with the other groups present in the room.
No, that's
I
not
have the
true.
Correspondence.
No.
But I think this is all. I think this is all very disingenuous when we're talking here about groups that represent the vast, vast majority of those children who are waiting for care. There's a huge amount of mistrust, and in fact, I just have to challenge Paul on lots of what he said, because the minister, first of all, can speak for himself. Paul doesn't have to speak for him, and I think there's a huge amount
well,
of. If I can make my point, when I spoke to the former head of the HSE. Who was the head of the HSE in 2017 when that commitment was given? I asked him, on what basis was that pledge given that no child would wait longer than 4 months? He said it was, of course, to increase capacity, treatment abroad, and in fact, many children did get access
okay.
to treatment abroad.
Can I ask you about treatment abroad?
No,
because
many did.
Something that was suggested, wasn't it?
But you're not allowing me to make the most important point, Claire. When that option was given, the waiting list came down. Then that stopped, the waiting list went back up again.
The and option then, for families to travel abroad for surgery.
For some, it's not an option for all. It's an option for some families because there are maybe some children who might be too sick.
Did the pandemic not intervene?
It was before the pandemic. This was before the pandemic when that stopped. And the point I made then about private healthcare is it's not just the surgery. There's pre-operative care, there's post-operative care, there's transitional care. There's those options for some children. And we're not using the totality of healthcare infrastructure.
Okay.
And then to make it worse, 19 million euro was given. And we don't know if it was spent for the purposes of which it was intended.
Okay.
So and nobody can stand over that. Not Paul, not Lorraine, and not me.
All right. We'll have to await the outcome of that audit and see that where that goes and whether we can get answers on where that money was spent. But while all of this is happening, there's still hundreds of children waiting for surgery. So we do appreciate Catherine Stewart and Kylie-Ann telling us their story today. We have to leave it there. My thanks to Una Keighley and to Paul Cullen. My other panellists are staying on with me. Coming up after the break, we speak to Dr. Umar Al-Qadri about his assault in Dublin last week. Welcome back. Last week, the chairperson of the Irish Muslim Council and chief imam, Dr. Umar Al-Qadri, was hospitalised following a suspected hate crime attack. The incident happened in Tallaght last Thursday evening and Garda investigations are ongoing. Dr. Al-Qadri joins us now in studio alongside my panellists Lorraine Clifford-Lee and David Cullinan, who are still with me. You're very welcome to the programme, Dr. Al-Qadri.
Thank you.
This attack happened, as we say, less than a week ago. How is your recovery going?
Thank God, the recovery is going well. I mean, when I work on a laptop, for more than 10, 15 minutes, I get very tired. Mm-hmm. But that's part of, I think, you know, having had a concussion. But for the rest, I'm really, you know, happy that the swelling is gone. The first few days, the swelling was severe. I couldn't open my mouth. Brushing teeth was very difficult. Now it's much better, much easier. So every day passes, recovery gets better, you know, it gets easier.
Within hours of your alleged assault in Tallaght last week, you say you experienced what was a deliberate hate crime attack. That's how you described it on social media. Why do you believe it was?
OK, first of all, this word alleged, I'm sorry, I don't like it. I have been a victim of a crime. I have been a victim of an attack. So that's not alleged.
As in, while Garda investigations are ongoing, it's an alleged hate crime in that regard.
It is an alleged hate crime.
We're speaking
to that. But it's not an alleged attack. An attack did take place. So the hate crime is the part that needs to be investigated. So the Garda is currently investigating this. If this was an attack on just me, you know, because for whatever reason, OK, that is fine. So many people get attacked. I'm not special. I'm an ordinary citizen of the country. I don't deserve the attention, but I don't think this was an attack, just random attack. I think this was a hate crime. Why? Because the people that attacked me, there is no other motive that I can see, particularly considering the current rhetoric that is very prevalent mm-hmm. online. I am very outspoken against extremism, against racism. I have been previously very outspoken against Islamist militants, against the people that kill innocent people in the name of Islam, in the name of my faith. And if I were attacked by someone coming from that background, I would know, and at least that the people would, you know, have a Muslim identity. These people that attacked me, they didn't look Muslim. They looked like just, you know, ordinary white people.
Yeah, so to explain that just to our audience, you found yourself in Tallaght because you had agreed to officiate at a Muslim marriage blessing.
Yes.
Who first contacted you and did it all appear to be normal?
Sure. So I was contacted, basically the phone line of the Islamic Centre gets forwarded to myself. If nobody picks up in the Islamic Centre, I pick the phone around 2 o'clock. And there was somebody with a very thick Irish accent in English asking, could the imam come down to do a wedding in the house? So I asked, well, first of all, tell me, who are you? Where are you calling from? And he said, I'm half Irish, I'm half Pakistani. That puts me at ease. And he then said, I'm born in the country. So there are so many people born in Ireland, you know, so many Muslims I know that have a very, very thick Irish accent. Mm-hmm. Unless you see them, you wouldn't know that they're actually second generation migrants. So then I asked him, who are you getting married with? Who is the lady? And he said she's from Algeria. So I said, if you send me a message on WhatsApp, I'll send you the application form and then I will get the document prepared and I'll come for the blessing. But why do you want it to take place in the house? Why don't you come to the Islamic Center? Because most people, not all, but most people would come to the Islamic Center. So he said, well, because we have family and we just want to do a small gathering at home, have the blessing at home. And that's fine, you know, we try to be as accommodating as
and
we
can. And so you agreed on that basis to go to Tallaght?
Exactly.
But when you arrived there, all was not as it seemed?
No, well, when I arrived there, the house, the address that I was given, there was only one car. There was no other car. So that, I asked, like, I thought to myself, if there was a blessing here, surely there would have been some guests. So I called the number and the person said, well, reverse the car, come back to the beginning of the street. I'm standing outside in front of the house. So I thought Google has probably brought me to a wrong address. I reversed the car and I saw then this person waving at me at the end of the street, parked the car, and I came out of the car and at the rear of my car, went towards him. I greeted him, Salaamu Alaikum. And he said, Wa Alaikum Salaam. Now, obviously, he was born, as he said, and he was half Irish, half Pakistani. So if he had an Irish accent like that, it's fine. Mm. The other person I saw looked very, you know, different. He looked very Irish, looked, you know, and he had a hoodie on. And then I looked towards my car and I just wanted to open the door so I could get the document, the marriage certificate with me. As soon as I looked towards the car, I just remember wanting to open the door. I don't remember anything after that. So they hit me. And when they hit me, I was knocked down. I felt unconscious. So I don't remember anything except I woke up in the car, in my own car, and there were people around me. There was a lady, Irish lady, there was two Irish men, and they were talking to me. They were telling me you were attacked and we've seen it and we've called the guard, we've called the ambulance. It took me 45 minutes. So by 9:30, the first message I sent was 9:30 p.m. from my phone to the management. There's a group for the mosque management, some of our volunteers. And I said, I'm here at this address, this location. I've been attacked. Please come. So within 15 minutes, 20 minutes, there were 5-6 people from my community
so
who were
you
there.
You received lots of support and people got you to Connolly Hospital in Blanchardstown, where you underwent a scan. But luckily, you have been released from hospital now and you are recovering at this point. You've said that Muslim clerics and faith leaders will need to review their personal safety. And not only that, that you believe security needs to be stepped up in mosques around the country. What sort of measures do you believe need to be introduced? And is this as a direct result of what happened to you and the fear that is now in the community?
Look, there have been attacks on places of worship throughout Europe, on synagogues, on churches, on mosques. And there is a rise of Islamophobia, anti-Semitism throughout Europe. Ireland so far hasn't been affected by it. But the last year or two, it seems we Irish are not immune to it. We're not immune to radicalization. So in Ireland, there is now this prevalence of this toxic rhetoric against migrants, against refugees, against Muslims that is so prevalent online that it's really shocking. And I think this is a consequence of that. The attack on me, this is what I believe. And of course, we have to wait until the Garda come and conclude with the investigation. And we will know for sure. But I suspect it to be a chain of that continuous increase of hatred in our society. And that is something that we need to do something about it. And we need mosques. Of course, they need to, they need to improve the security in terms of making sure they have CCTVs, working CCTVs, not just CCTVs, but actually that are working. They need to have some people within the mosque that can volunteer as security. If imams are traveling somewhere, obviously they shouldn't be traveling alone. So these kind of measurements, there are kind of precautions that they have to take now. And previously that we would not need, never imagined that we would have needed these in Ireland. But unfortunately, the truth is Ireland has changed.
OK, Ireland has changed, Umar says. What do you say to his story, to the attack that happened? And how concerned are you about it?
Well, firstly, I'd like to strongly condemn the attack and to wish Dr. Al-Qadri the very best in his recovery. I know it's you must be really, really shocked and dismayed, really, that something like this happened. And I know there's a live ongoing investigation, so I don't want to say too much about that other than the fact that people shouldn't be attacked and feel threatened mm-hmm. because of their religion, the colour of their skin, where they come from. And I think it's a really shocking situation. And I think he's very right in saying there's been a lot of toxic rhetoric on the national airwaves, on social media over the past number of months. And I've seen the rise of it. I think we did think we were special in Ireland. I think we thought we got integration right and what the problem that other countries were facing, we wouldn't face it because we're a country of immigrants and that we've gone to other countries and how could we right. ever hold it against anybody else? But I think this instance showed the real urgency with specific hate crime legislation. The government has been trying to progress that.
Would you agree with that, David Cullinan, that hate crime legislation will go some way towards helping in these situations, helping to prosecute people?
Well, first of all, I'm so sorry, Umar, that you were the victim of an assault and an attack. And it certainly seems to bear the hallmarks of a hate crime. Obviously, we'll have to wait and see from the Garda investigation, but there certainly was an assault. We don't need new legislation to deal with that. That can be dealt with under the current legislation. Obviously, this was a clear assault. I want to see the perpetrators brought to justice. I am concerned about the rise of extremism in relation to immigration. We can see it online. We can see it in some of the social media platforms. I do believe that it is a very, very small percentage of the population. It's extremely small. We saw some very ugly protests outside Leinster House and elsewhere in recent times as well. We've seen some protests that were peaceful on the issue of immigration. We have people who are raising what I would see as reasonable concerns in relation to immigration, want debate, want discussion. I don't believe that the vast, vast majority of Irish people who are very fair-minded would have any truck whatsoever with people who would perpetrate an assault like this. We need to send out a very clear message that it's wrong, take a zero-tolerance approach, and like any crime perpetrated against any person, the people responsible need to be brought to justice.
And yet when you've come out and you've told your story, that's been questioned, hasn't it, on social media? I just saw that in the last few days, that the reaction, while there's been, you know, solidarity from many, and we know that there was actually a solidarity march that took place in Talla on Monday from the Lekela anti-racism group, there have been others who've questioned your story and what happened to you. How worried are you by that? Or what do you think when you see that?
I think previously I heard about people, you know, questioning incidents and events. And obviously that kind of worries you as well. Like, you know, did these things really happen or not? So these conspiracy theories, you heard them about, you know, starting from the pandemic, the vaccine was supposed to have a chip in it. And this was like so prevalent and people believed in it. And now we have people questioning the attack that took place on me as a victim, knowing Gardaí was there, ambulance were there, there were Irish people there helping me, there were 5-6 people from my community there. I had a swollen face for the first 3-4 days. So I know it happened. Mm-hmm. I know it happened. So irrespective of whether somebody believes or not, and I think the Gardaí will obviously, their investigation, I look forward to it, that it concludes and we will find out, you know, why these people did what they did, what their motivation was.
All right. And we wish you well in your recovery. Thank you for joining us on the programme tonight. Coming up after the break, the US is to push for a temporary ceasefire. Do stay with us. Welcome back. The United States is to push for a temporary halt in fighting in Gaza, using the word ceasefire for the first time. It's drafted a proposed resolution for the UN Security Council, but had previously avoided using ceasefire during UN votes on the war.
Our text calls for a temporary ceasefire in Gaza as soon as practicable, based on the formula of all hostages being released. Under current circumstances, a major ground offensive into Rafah should not proceed.
Well, earlier, the US vetoed an Arab-backed UN resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. We're joined now down the line by Dunico Bacon, Professor of Politics at DCU. Thanks for joining us on the programme tonight, Dunica. The US, as expected, vetoed this UN resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire. It was an Algerian resolution. This was expected, wasn't it?
It was expected. It was depressingly predictable and familiar. This is the third time now that the US has vetoed a resolution which otherwise would have passed. It exercised its veto powers as a permanent member of the UN Security Council. The first time it did that was in October of last year, when 1,000 people had died as a result of Israel's assault on Gaza. Now that figure is almost 30,000. So the cost in terms of human life for those vetoes has been huge. Almost 30,000 people dead, most of those women and children, almost 80,000 injured. And of course, there's the loss of life and limb. So this is something that the US had flagged in advance. And it shows, I think, the desperation of the other countries that they still pushed ahead. They wanted to make a stand on this issue, even though they knew the US would exercise its veto.
Of course, now what we have, which could be significant, the US coming up with their own rival resolution. How meaningful is it? They are calling for a temporary ceasefire. It's the first time that they've uttered those words in relation to what's happening in Gaza.
Well, there has been a lot of speculation and interpretation about the use of the word ceasefire. But to be honest, it seems like a mechanism by which the US is trying to demonstrate that it's in the UN not simply as a destructive power blocking other people's initiatives, but it has a plan of its own. Whether it can get the agreement of the other members of the UN Security Council is questionable, because this will be a wide-ranging package. Now, the US has said that it's got a lot of time, that it will deliberate with other countries. But as we know, I mean, delay in Gaza means deaths, an average of 230 every day. So time is of the essence. But it's also, when they mention the word ceasefire, they say it will be a temporary ceasefire and as soon as it's practicable. And all those kind of details about when the circumstances would allow for this temporary ceasefire, they still have to be fleshed out by agreement with the other partners in the UN Security Council.
So we don't have a date for when this resolution will be brought before the UN Security Council, although we do have, I suppose, a pledge to do something. Yeah, on this, I mean, how will Israel view it? How will it be viewed internationally? You're saying all countries may not get on board. Is that because of T's and C's contained within?
Absolutely. I mean, it will be, so the US ambassador to the UN suggested today, quite a wide-ranging package, and there may be items in it that won't find agreements amongst, for example, Arab states such as Algeria, which sponsored the motion today. But I think it's still very important, the fact that this Algerian motion today had the support of France, of Korea, of Japan, of Switzerland, of Slovenia, of Malta. All those countries would be considered allies of the US. So the US is really out on a limb here. And, you know, the question regarding whether the UN, if the US managed to get a motion passed, even calling for a temporary ceasefire. By the way, the US ambassador also said that this draft resolution would call on Israel not to launch a ground offensive on Rafah. It's not clear that Israel would abide by any UN resolution. It's made it clear over and over again that it sees itself as, you know, rhetorically abiding by international law, but de facto above international law. It's dismissed, the International Court of Justice. It dismisses UN resolutions. So it's not clear, who would implement any UN resolution if it was passed.
All right. So at this point, we don't know. As I say, we're still waiting on a potential date for that. And then the outcome also is unclear as far as you're concerned, Dunica. There we'll have to leave it. My thanks to you, Dunica, for bringing us up to date on that and the latest efforts around securing some sort of a temporary halt to what's happening in Gaza. There we'll have to leave it. My thanks to all our panellists tonight. Our programme is available as a podcast on all major platforms. And you can also now find us on Instagram and on TikTok. But from all the late team here, good night. Take care.
Hold up.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.